You've landed on Cross Defense, that unique program where we talk about apologetics, intellectual questions that people of all ages have. I'm your host, Rod Zwanitzer, welcoming you in on this Monday, June the 9th, 2014, broadcasting live from the studios at the International Center, the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, St. Louis, Missouri. So much of today, we hear talk about religion being trumped by people that want to put everything on matter, on material, and nothing else will have a chance. So today we're talking about this topic, the apologetics of materialism. We have a great guest, an expert to talk with us about this, Dr. Angus Manoush, author, apologist, and professor at Concordia University, Wisconsin. Welcome to Cross Defense, Angus.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show, Rod.
It's great to visit with you again. Now, let's start off by making sure we're all on the same page. Can you define for us what is meant by materialism?
Yeah, philosophical materialism is the view that the physical world is all there is. So there's only physical stuff, and there are only undirected causes, things that happen by chance, things that happen because of necessity. But there's no God, there are no souls. And it has a problem, really, with all of the higher things, consciousness, intentionality, the ability that we have to think about things beyond ourselves, reason, moral values, and moral obligations. It has to say that all of these things somehow emerged from matter when it became complicated enough. So it sometimes is called a matter-first view. In the beginning, stuff. And later on, all of these higher things somehow emerge when the stuff becomes complicated enough.
By definition, if matter is all that there is, everything would have to come from matter. So, and also, this materialism is linked most of the time, is it not, with the assumption, with the conviction that it's the commitment to materialism that is the only scientific attitude worldview that would be allowable.
Right, yeah. What drives it is a methodology, the rule, sometimes called methodological naturalism, that says that within science, at least, you can only ever consider natural causes to account for any phenomena. So by definition, within science, you can't consider God's action, or a miracle, or even the work of the human soul. All of those are excluded by definition before you investigate the evidence, which if you think about it, is a rather odd thing to do. It's rather like saying that the treasure must not be on a certain part of an island because there the map says, here there be dragons, and we don't want to go there. And so the odd thing about the rise of materialism is it depends ultimately on a decision not to consider certain kinds of causes as explanatory. And, of course, there's no way to guarantee that that decision is correct.
So it's that old presuppositionalism that jumps in there and says, we presuppose that all these other competitors can't even be possible, so we're not even going to let them enter into the discussion.
Yeah, and so what happens, it's a bit like if I'm not very good at tennis, which, by the way, I'm not. Well, what I could do is make sure that I only play with other people who aren't very good at tennis, and then perhaps I can do quite well. And the worry about this rule, methodological naturalism, is the output of it will be the best naturalistic or materialistic explanation. Of course, it could still be a horrible explanation because it could be that the truth is that God is the best explanation, but that was never considered. It wasn't allowed to compete in the race.
Angus, would you say that naturalism is a synonym of materialism?
Well, naturalism, as it's used in philosophy, is broader. There are a range of different views that call themselves naturalistic. There are very austere naturalists who even have problems with human consciousness. You have people like the Churchlands, Paul and Patricia Churchland, who seem to doubt whether we have conscious mental states, which is a kind of remarkable position to come to by studying the brain and thinking that what we can observe in the brain is all there is, that led to question whether we have beliefs and desires. So that's sometimes called strict naturalism. But most philosophers embrace some broader notion of naturalism. Well, I claim, yeah, you know, there are these higher things. There is consciousness, there is reason, and so forth. But somehow they emerge, they are added on. And so popular today in the philosophy of mind and other areas of philosophy is the idea of non-reductive materialism, where you say that matter just has this amazing ability to generate these higher entities when matter becomes sophisticated or complicated enough. So there's a kind of a spectrum of views, from very strict to a little bit more open. But the one thing they have in common, of course, is that matter comes first. Matter is driving the bus, and everything else must be dependent on it.
Now, this is an area that can get pretty technical when you're talking among trained philosophers such as yourself. I remember reading your fine book, Agents Under Fire: Materialism and the Rationality of Science, and it was a good exercise for my gray matter, because it's like anything, like theology or any area of pursuit of interest and knowledge. Develop your own vocabulary. It has to be pretty precise. You have to understand you're talking about the same things. But in general, just for the layperson out there, Angus, what are the main problems with these worldviews of naturalism and materialism that, you know, the average Joe Blow and Mary Blow on the street can be aware of when they're conversing with their non-believer friends?
Yeah, basically, it's that they have to say that entities that you're really very surprising somehow just emerge, and their explanation is weak. And I'll give you briefly four examples. Consciousness, okay? We're all aware of things going on in the world. We have a certain point of view on the world. We feel pain, happiness. We enjoy a sunset, and so forth. And yet, when we look at the brain, as it is studied by materialistic neuroscience, it can be fully understood in impersonal terms. None of those accounts imply that the brain is conscious or aware of anything. And so the fact of the matter is that consciousness is extremely surprising given their worldview. Now notice, if we bring theism into the picture, it's not surprising, because God has always been conscious. And if we bring in the idea that we're made in the image of God, well then that explains how we can be conscious, because we are like God. See, we don't have to say that consciousness emerges from the unconscious, which is what the materialist has to say. And going on down the line, that same pattern emerges. Intentionality, now that's a fancy term. It just means that we can think about things. We can think about something that exists, like a tree, something that doesn't exist, like a vacation, something that won't exist, the vacation is canceled, things that don't exist at all, like leprechauns, or can't exist, perhaps, like round squares. We have an amazing ability to think about things other than ourselves. Well, yet again, when we look at the brain, much as when we look at a computer, nothing about materialistic accounts of those objects imply that their states are about anything beyond themselves. And so our ability to think about the world, again, is incredibly surprising given materialism, but it's not surprising given the Christian understanding, because God has always existed, and God thinks about the world and knows all things. And so, again, intentionality is not something new. God has always had that, and we have it because we're made in his image. Blaise Pascal made this wonderful claim in his book, The Pensée, Through space, the universe grasps me and swallows me up like a speck. So physically, I'm very small and insignificant. Then he said, through thought, I grasp it. And think about this remarkable fact. The entire physical universe is not thinking about you and me, but we can think about the entire universe. So it's very clear that physical complexity can't be the explanation. If it were, why is it when you have a crowd of conscious people, you don't get an additional conscious person by putting those people together? So the materialistic account of these things is very implausible, but it makes sense if God exists. And maybe the most powerful argument, though, is the argument from reason. This was stated by C.S. Lewis in his book Miracles in Chapter 3. He called it the cardinal difficulty of naturalism. And he pointed out that if we are simply the result of blind, undirected, naturalistic evolution, then we can't really rely on our own reasoning. And the reason is that natural selection simply cares about useful behavior, behavior that keeps you alive. And you will survive if, for example, you stay away from lions or you find food. It doesn't really matter whether your beliefs are mostly true. And so the materialistic account struggles to explain how we can have reliable minds and how we're also able to contact laws of logic, you know, laws of logic which are always true, rather than just have usually worked in our environment. So we know that if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C always and necessarily. It's not just that it's usually worked for creatures like us. And so the way that we reason implies that we're able to transcend just the physical limitations of this world. In fact, the very fact that we can state the cosmological argument, which says that, well, the universe began to exist, anything that begins to exist has a cause, the universe has a cause. Note that that requires us to transcend the universe and think about its origin. That's very difficult, really, for materialism to give a good account of. But again, reason makes perfect sense if it's rooted in the reason of God. Lewis has a wonderful statement on this. He says, the theist is not committed to the view that reason is a comparatively recent development molded by a process of selection. For him, reason, the reason of God, is older than nature, and from it, the orderliness of nature, which alone enables us to know her, is derived. For him, the human mind, in the act of knowing, is illuminated by divine reason. And so what he's saying is that the reason in God's mind is found both in the laws of nature, that's why we can do science, the world makes sense, but it's also reflected in a limited way in the human mind, and that's why our mind is attuned to discovering those laws. That's why we can do science. So there's very powerful reason to think that human rationality makes much more sense given God's existence than given materialism.
So then, it sounds very much like, Angus, correct me if I'm wrong, that the very fact that science has all these wonderful interest in transcendent things and wants to know how everything fits together, their answers are very surprising when we think about them, and they don't adhere together very well, where the theistic side, and for those listeners out there that might not be familiar with these words we're using, theism and theist and so forth, they come from the Greek word for God, theos. They supply a lot of answers. And you were hitting on, a key area there that you wrote about in a little article that Nancy Piercy published, that materialism really kind of undermines the whole foundation for science, and you were starting to go there. I think that's very critical to talk about, is it not?
You see, today we've got a lot of people, the new atheists, who claim you don't need philosophy. You can just do science, and philosophy is out of the job. But the fact is, if you talk to historians and philosophers of science, they all say, wait a minute, before you do science, you have to assume that the world is orderly and that your mind is capable of discerning that order. Otherwise, science is a waste of time. So scientists do make philosophical presuppositions. Now, the problem with this materialistic approach is it undermines confidence in our own reasoning, but then, of course, that would lead us to think that we can't do science. And notice that something really bizarre happens here. We were told we should be materialists because that's the scientific attitude, and yet materialism leads us to believe that we can't do science. And so what materialism ends up doing is undermining its own foundation.
Are you saying, Angus, that not only does it say that when we start doing it, we can't be confident, but it also says that when we do it, we're not sure at all what we're looking at, where the theistic view says, oh yeah, you can not only be interested, but when you do it, you can have some confidence when it makes sense and it fits into an order, and thus.
Yeah, I mean, for example, as Nancy Piercy, you mentioned, points out, historians of science have argued that the very idea of the law of nature is inherently theistic. It's the idea that God governs the world with coherent providential plans. That's how Kepler understood a law of nature, that was God's way of governing the universe. Well, you take God out of the picture, as a materialist does, why exactly should you expect there to be any laws that govern matter? Why shouldn't matter just do its own thing in a thoroughly incoherent way? And then even if we can reason, there's not going to be any intelligible order to discover. And Eugene Wigner wrote a famous paper on this called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics. And what he said was so miraculous was the fact that we can have elegant mathematical formula in which we state the laws of nature. That's not something that should be taken for granted. I mean, Einstein himself made a comment on that and said that really, a priori, we should expect that a chaotic world which cannot be grasped by the mind in any way. And he said the kind of order that you discover in Newton's physics, for example, is wholly different. The success of such a project, he says, presupposes a high degree of ordering of the objective world. And so Einstein, although he was not a Christian, did accept you had to postulate some sort of logos, some sort of rational order that was really there in the cosmos. Otherwise, you wouldn't expect to find these laws.
And it turns out, does it not, as Kepler found so wonderfully, that when you start understanding that there is an intelligent designer, a God out there who has not only created and established all these laws of nature, but he's given humans the interest and the ability to investigate and discover, and as you were talking there, to have confidence in the results, even mathematical precision, that adheres much better to the theistic worldview than to the materialistic worldview.
Yeah, it does. And it's interesting, it goes back to our first and universal vocation, namely to be stewards of the natural world. And if you think it through, how are we going to be stewards of the natural world unless we understand it? So arguably, that stewardship call is a call to be scientists. And, you know, God equips those that he calls. And so the reason that we have these higher order gifts, that we have a reason and a consciousness and intentionality that can think about universal issues, that's necessary if we're ever even able to conceive the idea of a universal law of nature. And it's fascinating that the materialists take this for granted. They're always talking about their hope for a theory of everything that will explain anything. And their idea is if they came up with a universal theory that explained everything, that therefore somehow that puts God out of a job. Where in fact, the very idea that there could be universal laws of nature shows us something quite remarkable about human beings. And that we're gifted to understand the world. So what they're relying on, actually, is borrowed capital. They're relying on gifts that come from the hand of God, and unfortunately using them to try and discredit God.
Now let's turn, and you've been touching on it a little bit, but let's really zero in on it, because I think it's important, some of the things that you've written, that knowledge is so important to this discussion. So why is it that knowing something is vital to the scientific enterprise, and maybe even to just being a human, you know, as you were stating there, and I always find it fascinating, and the Bible seems to quote this all over, that when we look at the stars and the heavens and the magnificence of the universe, it starts, you know, our thought process flowing of wanting to understand that, you know, as Kepler and the others were interested in, how does it all hold together, you know, the gravitational, you know, field and all that, and planetary motions and all that. And from then, it rubs off into even more finer scientific questions and discoveries down here on Earth, moving from the heaven down to the Earth.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you think about it from a consistent materialistic perspective, our chance of understanding the whole cosmos would be even less than the chances of a little piece of dust on a carpet understanding the whole pattern. Because from that point of view, all we are local contingent phenomena stuck somewhere in the middle of everything. We wouldn't have any access to any transcendent points of reference to understand the whole thing. See, being made in the image of God is critical, because otherwise you don't have any access to those universal principles of laws and mathematics and logic and all the rest of it that science relies on. And so knowledge is the key. You know, and I have a good friend out in Biola University in California who's argued quite rigorously, too, that naturalism has a hard time accounting for our knowledge of anything, even physical objects, because the trouble is, It basically, we end up just being physical objects ourselves, and there we are in our brain, okay? And suppose we have some experiences. Now, they don't, I think, explain consciousness, but let's ignore that. Now we have the classic skeptical problem of why should we think any of our experiences line up with the way the world really is? And they have terrible difficulty in getting beyond that problem, because we're sort of stuck inside of this prison of our brain, and we're trying to interpret what its deliverances mean. Now, if in fact we are made in the image of God and we are a unity, an integrated whole of soul, body, and spirit, and we're given those gifts in order to understand the world as it is in itself, then we can do science, we can discover facts, and we can start to discern what's really going on in the world.
So if materialism is really true, is it possible to have any kind of knowledge? You seem to be suggesting it's not.
Well, that's the thesis of Scott Smith's book, and it's interesting. The materialism can be attacked on two fronts. It actually undermines both the idea that we're able to transcend our limitations to know the world as it is, to get outside of our brains. But it also makes you wonder if there's anything in the world to know, because if you take God out of the picture and there are no natures or essences to things, nothing is designed, nothing really, you know, has a given nature. It's just a historical accident that's transitioning into something else. Then you start to question whether there's anything in the world to know, and the whole thing falls apart. It's kind of like W.B. Yeats' poem, The Second Coming, where he says...
Let's hold that important part and pick it up on the other side of this break. You're listening to Cross Defense. We're talking with Dr. Angus Manoos about the apologetics of materialism. We'll be right back.
Worldwide KFUO salutes our day sponsor on this Monday, June 9th, 2014. Today's day sponsors are Roger and Janet Altavoet. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to Worldwide KFUO in thanksgiving to the Lord for the many blessings He has given them in these 52 years of marriage.
Once again, we say thank you to Roger and Janet Altavogt of Florissant, Missouri, today's worldwide KFUO Day sponsor.
Teaching the faith, spiritual care, acts of mercy. These describe the work of a deaconess. Your pastor provides you with word and sacrament ministry. Consider a deaconess to aid him through other means of caring for your congregation. Her loving hands can bring Christ's love in specific ways tailored to meet your congregation's needs. You have a need, consider a deaconess. For more information, please contact your district president.
Let Worldwide KFUO help you get the word out about your next church, school, or organization event. By including your event in the KFUO datebook, it will be announced on the air throughout the day. Send your event information via email to jennyw@kfuo.org. That's J-E-N-N-Y-W @kfuo.org. Or call 314-996-1515. Be sure to include date, time, location, and contact information. The KFUO datebook is a public service of listener-supported Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Serving seniors wherever they call home. That's Lutheran Senior Services Home Health. For those who need to regain independence after an injury, illness, or decline in health or ability, Lutheran Senior Services Home Health can arrange for a variety of skilled services that will help older adults recover where they feel most comfortable, at home. Doctor's referral required, Medicare certified. Lutheran Senior Services Home Health. Learn more at lssliving.org.
Hey, Craig D'Onofrio here. Join me on the next Reformation Rush Hour. We'll talk with attorney Rob Doty about all sorts of cases that are going on that affect the church and our faith. We'll also talk with the Reverend Dr. C.J. Armstrong from Concordia University, Irvine, about reading the Gospel of St. Luke as an apologetics textbook. We'll find out all about that and much, much more on the next Reformation Rush Hour, 5 p.m., right after Issues Etc. on Worldwide KFUO.
Did you know that more than 38 million people in America speak Spanish? You can share the gospel with them in their own language using a new resource from Lutheran Heritage Foundation, the Spanish Bible with Small Catechism. Like all the books LHF translates and publishes, the Spanish Bible is available at no cost to the people and ministries who need them. LHF 800-554-0723 or visit lhfmissions.org.
Pope Francis has welcomed the Israeli and Palestinian presidents to the Vatican for a remarkable evening of prayers for peace. Israeli President Shimon Peres and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas embraced Sunday in the foyer of the Vatican Hotel where Francis lives, and later in the Vatican Gardens, where they joined Francis in presiding over an invocation of Jewish, Christian, and Muslim prayers. The prayers focused on themes common to each of the religions, thanking God for creation, seeking for forgiveness for past wrongdoing, and praying to God to bring peace to the region. Perez said,
"Your Holiness, your wisdom and modesty have gathered us here."
The Pope told Perez and Abbas that too many children have been killed and that their memory should instill the strength and patience to work for dialogue and coexistence. The prayer summit was organized in the 2 weeks since Francis issued the surprise invitation from Manger Square in Bethlehem. I'm Steve Coleman.
So glad you're with us today on Cross Defense, because we're talking about a topic that you might not even know it or not, but some people get so hung up on this that they will even say it in common terms, and thus we should be ready to have a defense. And so to help us with that, our guest today, Dr. Angus Manoush. He's professor at Concordia University in Wisconsin, and there he teaches philosophy and apologetics. Dr. Manoush, we were talking about knowledge being important to this discussion, and the ways that theism and materialism approach knowledge. You were off on that, and then rudely I had to interrupt you.
That's fine. I was just saying that the theism as well gives you a better account of the objects of knowledge, because if we live in a world where things are created by God, well, then they have a definite defining nature. They are just what God intended them to be. So you also have a world that can be known because you have definite objects of knowledge. The problem with materialism is, in fact, G.K. Chesterton noticed this, is he says it actually undermines the very idea of a thing, because everything really is in flux. It's always in the process of becoming something else. And so, you know, how can you really know any object if, in fact, it's really just transitioning to something else? And this is very real. When we look at human beings, okay, and we look closely at what's going on in the brain, the fact of the matter is the brain is in constant flux. It's always either adding or losing matter or energy. It doesn't stay the same over time. And if we based our personal identity simply on the brain, then we'd have a very difficult time accounting for a personal identity. Whereas if we base it on a soul, something that transcends the brain, well, that as a mental substance can endure over time. And so going back to, well, what did God intend things to be, can give us definite objects of knowledge. That's also why we believe there are laws of nature. Well, they're his laws. Take God out of the picture. You don't have definite objects. You don't have definite laws. And so the very idea of a reality to know becomes suspect. And you can go far enough down this road and you end up with Richard Rorty, American philosopher, who said that in the name of keeping faith with Darwin, he concluded there was no objective truth with a capital T. And the reason is, well, that would imply that there was some reality inscribed in nature by God. And so rather pathetically, he has to substitute the idea of truth with a small t, which just means the consensus of human beings, which, of course, is constantly changing. And as we know, an awful lot of human beings can be completely wrong.
So it appears that materialists are not really philosophically consistent all the time, because if they were, they would struggle to even be able to observe and report on objects or things. So they seem to even beg, borrow, and steal from theism to be able to do rational science. And yet, as you point out, they're always telling us that we theists can't really do science and are not scientists because we don't applaud and hold to the same presuppositions such as materialism or Darwinism, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the truth of the matter, is that contemporary naturalism is still in many ways living on borrowed capital. It helps itself to the rationality of the science, to laws of nature, and all sorts of categories, which really are better at home in a Christian theistic framework. It continues to use them, kind of separating the branches from the vine, as it were. And of course, they really have no foundation. But in a way, it's the essence of idolatry. I've thought about this a lot, and really, materialism is intellectually an act of idolatry. It's taking all sorts of gifts of God and then divinizing them. And so what happens is the physical world, the laws of nature, are treated as if they are the ultimate reality, as if they are God. And meanwhile, there'd be no reason to believe in any of these things unless God existed.
Wow. And, you know, it kind of shocks one when you run into someone that's seems to be intelligent, seems to be a nice human being, and then has such weird views. For instance, I ran into a pantheist the other day. I believe he's Hindu. And we were talking about a natural phenomena in my very backyard, a yard that he and I share, of a doe deer who I think really just had a beautiful little fawn that very day and was nursing it and licking it right there. And I was talking to him about this and how fantastic it was to see it right in our own space. And he says to me, well, you know, it's really a mistake that we humans are only here to take care of these animals, these great and exquisite animals, and that we botch it up. And I said to him, hold it. That's totally foreign to what I think. I think that God has put us here, as you said, Angus, to be stewards, to be managers of all this, to take great care of it. But more important is us. They were made for us, not us for them. And he was flip-flopping that all around. And that's kind of what I hear you saying, too, is materialism, naturalism wants to put all that on its head. And it doesn't make any sense. It does not adhere.
Yeah, and it's sad that the way that people are educated, if we use this raw methodological naturalism, they hear the evidence that supports a naturalistic point of view. They don't hear the case on the other side. And I find that many of the best naturalistic philosophers have, frankly, a second-grade understanding of Christian philosophical alternatives. For them, theism is sort of this pre-philosophical understanding of things, the superstitions of the past. Naturalism is when you figure out how things really work. But again, in the process, they're making use of concepts without thinking whether they're really at home in their own worldview. And what the best Christian philosophers are doing today is simply saying, what we need to do is to have a fair side-by-side comparison. Here's the phenomena we all agree, consciousness, rationality, moral values and obligations and so forth. Which worldview actually makes the best sense of them instead of, well, what is the best, latest, naturalistic account of them, which is not an open contest of ideas at all.
That's a good point. You know, is it true that I know on the theological end where I've spent a lot of decades here recently, the liberal side will never even acknowledge the more conservative side, which I'm a part of, and so it's hard to talk because they're always wanting to talk about the latest liberal thing, and you're suggesting, well let's just lay both positions out there on specific issues, in your case the philosophical, and see how they come out. Same thing on the theological side, and that resistance to do that kind of I think allows them to live in an unjuried and unvetted place where it's kind of like they're almost, it seems, afraid to even have that moment of comparison to see what the other side is saying and thinking.
Yeah, and it's kind of a sad situation because most of us here on the theistic side spend the majority of our time reading books by materialists and atheists and skeptics and all the rest of it so that we respond to them. And there are only a few on the other side who, you know, show the same courtesy. It's become very easy because of the establishment of these views in the major universities for them to frankly be lazy and to listen to, people in their own choir. And so they can have intramural discussions on the best versions of materialism or naturalism, but very few of them are willing to be deeply challenged on whether their whole paradigm could be mistaken. I think that's disappointing intellectually. And you think about the great debates in the past, you know, where G.K. Chesterton would take on George Bernard Shaw, and they had very different worldviews, but they were able to have a worthwhile discussion and probe the apparent strengths and weaknesses on either side. We just don't seem to have that level of civil discourse anymore. People find it very easy to silo themselves and talk to and think amongst those people who at a fundamental level agree with them.
I think especially for younger minds, a lot of them are not as aware as some of us, as you say, that spend the time to I've always thought before I can critique someone else's theology, I better darn well know what their theology is and its major points and be able to articulate them so even the opponent would know that I know where he's coming from. I remember when I first graduated, Angus, I was talking to a Roman Catholic priest right across the alley from where I was in Canada, and he and another priest that we were having tea, they started talking about a pretty famous Roman Catholic theologian. All of a sudden, they caught themselves and said, oh, we're so sorry, we're talking to this Lutheran here. And I said, well, it's amazing that in a class I took on Roman Catholic theology, I had to research and report to the class on this guy. And when I told them I read four of his books, they were stunned. And they were so impressed that I knew it. And then I asked them, how much of Walther or Pieper or Chemnitz have you read? And they hadn't read any even of Luther. And so I think that point could be made with a lot of disciplines as you're talking here philosophically. And it's amazing when younger people find out that a lot of academia today says they're so open-minded when they're very closed-minded, as you're saying, and very intramural. I'm fascinated when you talk about materialism, naturalism as kind of being intellectual idolatry. Where can we bring Jesus Christ into this discussion, do you think, Angus? Or can we? Or should we?
Well, I think in the end, we always should aim to do that. In Christ, all things hold together. And, you know, he is before all things. Everything was made through him. So I think that one of the problems with just dealing with materialism is that one can be fixated just on arguing the case for a God, but which God? And if we don't answer that, we're not taking people to the foot of the cross. So I think ultimately, once one's shown there is a case for God, we should move on and look at the case for the New Testament, the case for the resurrection of Christ. Then we should point out that if people are willing to entertain the existence of God, they should be very interested in who that God is. And then as they look at the various world religions, they should also be very interested if any of them are significantly different, if any of them actually make claims that you can check out. And I think our society, because of, you know, what's called moralistic therapeutic deism, takes this kind of view that all religions are the same in that they're comforting therapeutic systems, and that none of them actually makes any claims that can be checked out. And, of course, we know that's completely false. In the case of Christianity, it makes numerous historical claims, and it has testimony, eyewitness testimony to back it up. I think we ought to engage them at that level. If they're open at all to the idea of God's existence, to get them to see it really matters who God is, because nobody is going to be saved from their predicament by how they think about God or how they prefer God to be. They'll only be saved by the true God, and they really ought to find out who that God is.
Very good things that you're saying there. When we begin to share who this Theos is, this God that we believe in, and the magnificent things that he's done, it would appear to me that if we can start to talk about these huge differences in the world religions, I like what John Warwick Montgomery in one of his tomes said, where he starts out by saying the only thing that the world religions share in common is that they totally contradict each other.
Yes.
And that's so true when you find it out. Yeah. They are so different, and yet, as you say, our world today wants to say they're all in the same pot, they lead to the same thing, and we've got to say no. And isn't one of the major things is that our God, the true God, he took on flesh and matter. And in a lot of religions, that is really evil. We know that.
Right. And it's interesting that in that sense, you know, God condescends to make a gesture towards the materialists. You know, the natural man would much prefer something like Gnosticism. That's all spiritual. And so the body is the prison house, and then you just want to be free, and you want to be spiritual. And, of course, you want to as well be your own God. And Christianity says nothing of the kind. It says, interestingly, here we've been criticizing materialism, and yet God likes matter. It was his idea. He created it. Adam has a material, perfected body. Our resurrected bodies are going to be physical bodies under the governance of the Spirit, no longer subject to corruption. And so what that means, though, is that there are traces that can be checked out in the physical world. because God became man at a particular time and place, and there are historical records of his life and his death and his resurrection, and they can be checked out because they happened in history, and that's just so important and so unique, as well as the teaching about how we become right with God. You know, this kind of moral gap argument is very important, that here we are unholy and you have God's holiness. There's a huge gap between us. How is that gap going to be bridged? Really, the other world's religions, in one way or another, they say that we bridge the gap. Either somehow God is willing to accept less than the perfect standard, which seems to be what Islam teaches, a great abundance of good over bad deeds. Or if you have enough tries, some version of reincarnation and working off bad karma and so forth. But they basically teach that eventually you will get yourself to God. And when we realize that this is a perfect and holy standard and we're honest about our own inadequacies, we should quickly conclude that this is just impossible. There's no way that we can get there from here. Then Christianity, again, is unique because it's the only religion that says that God bridges the gap in Christ. He comes to us, shows his solidarity with us and our suffering, but he also lives the life, the perfect life that we couldn't live, and pays the full punishment for all the sins that we have ever committed or will commit. That's a very unique solution to how we get right with God.
And you know what stirred me up as you were speaking about all that, Angus, is that the Bible clearly teaches that all human beings naturally, by nature, know that the Creator God is out there, but they don't know who he is or what he thinks about them until it's supernaturally revealed in the Word of God, and that Word of God made flesh, Jesus Christ, who lets us know that we really can know the one true God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And he's left witnesses, eyewitness testimony. And it's not what some people say. I know you're into this as I am and why the program is here. A lot of our younger people today, and even older people for that matter, they're getting real frustrated with pastors and the church when they want to talk these intellectual questions that we're talking, kicking around today. And the church says to them, don't worry about it. Just have faith in it. No, the Bible, the first disciples, followers of Jesus, they didn't believe in him resurrected just because somebody told them that. They had evidence, and they were eyewitnesses of that evidence. And Christianity is the only religion I know of that proceeds like that. It's fantastic. When that Holy Spirit bursts through our evil presuppositions and says, hey, consider this, that this God in history did all this, and here's the real McCoy, not these false ones. It truly is life-changing, isn't it not?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, that's what you see with Paul. You know, he gave what he first received, something objective, and hence his pattern is proclamation defense. He's always doing evangelism. He speaks the gospel and he defends the gospel. He does the two together. He doesn't do one or the other. And it's because we've gotten away from the idea that faith has these three dimensions. It's got the notitia, the historical knowledge. It's got the assensus, the intellectual assent of the mind, where the mind can say, yes, this is true. And fiducia, the trust of the heart. And in our age, because it's so therapeutic, we only focus on the trust. And if you do that, the problem is that people are likely to delude themselves into saying, well, I have faith in what works for me. There's no object of faith. What those other dimensions do is they keep you rooted in the object of faith. And so in the Bible, it surprises us over and over again where they talk about matters of faith as things that are known. That's fascinating because today, faith is almost by definition something that you don't know. And it's all in your mind. It's subjective and it has no real connection to reality. And yet biblical faith is something that is known. And there are many evidences of it. And we're talking about a historical matter that can be checked out. So when Paul is, you know, in front of a gripper and he says, well, has your great learning driven you out of your mind? He doesn't give a psychological defense and say, no, I'm feeling quite well, because that's subjective. He says that, you know, the king knows about these things. They haven't been done in a corner. He appeals to historical, factual information that the king has. And that is so significant, and we need to recover that idea in the church, that what we believe in faith and trust in our heart is also true. And it's not a different kind of truth because, you know, it's a matter of faith. It's the same kind of truth that applies anywhere else.
Very good. Now, let's finish with this with just a couple of minutes left. You wrote a sentence I really liked, and I'm going to substitute here materialism for naturalism, Angus. Materialism may look like an invincible nuclear submarine, but critical thinking theists, again, those who believe in God, and for us, it's Father, Son, Holy Spirit, have developed a salvo of countermeasures. What would you suggest to our listeners out there are the best of these countermeasures that they can look at? And you might share with them, too, what would be a good source for the average layperson to begin looking into this topic of countering materialism?
Well, I mean, the argument from reason. A very good book there is the one by Victor Rappert, because it's an accessible book called C.S. Lewis's Dangerous Idea, and that develops the argument from reason. There's some great stuff on defending the image of God by J.P. Moreland. He's got a book, The Recalcitrant Imago Dei. Now, if that's a bit too difficult for someone, he has a brand new book that's very accessible called The Soul, and it's a defense, really, of the nature of man. There's lots of good books out there that deal with the moral dimension. There's a great book called Good God by David Beckett and Jerry Wolves, and that defends the theistic foundation for morality. And, you know, there are more popular works in that area. He's written many academic works, but Paul Copan also has some fairly popular books in that area, defending the idea that our moral obligations and moral standards can only be understood in the context of God. There's just a lot of resources. A good popular apologist I just ran into in a conference in Poland, whose books I recommend because they're very clear, is Peter S. Williams. He's based in Southampton, England, and he has a lot of very good books on apologetics, including C.S. Lewis versus the New Atheist, which is a nice, accessible book that shows how Lewis really anticipates and gives good responses to, you know, people like Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and so forth.
Yeah, and if you want to get stretched in a positive way, do what I did. Read Dr. Manuja's excellent book, Agents Under Fire. I like that one. I wish we had time to get into the cranes and all that, but I loved all that imagery that you used there, Angus. Very good book. And we thank you for being our guest today, talking about the apologetics of materialism. Thanks for being such a great apologist, and hope to have you back soon here on Cross Defense.
Thanks very much for having me on the show, and blessings on your ministry there.
Thank you so much. Join us next week when we will talk about intellectual questions and their answers from a Christian perspective here on Cross Defense.